So we have Tom Jackson in the studio, who's going to be interviewing the parents of Rachel Corrie, who was killed by an Israeli bulldozer protecting a Palestinian home. So we're just going to get all set up here and bring you that interview live on WSCA LP Portsmouth 106.1 FM.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Jackson. And as Stanley said, we're going to be talking with the parents of Rachel Corrie, and just by way of a little bit of background, mainly because this is a story that was not widely covered on mainstream media, to say the least. Did get some coverage on progressive media, but just a little bit of background on what happened. Rachel Corrie, who was 23, was working with the International Solidarity Movement. She was on the Gaza Strip, and on March 16th, 2003, an Israeli soldier driving a bulldozer, this soldier was part of the Israeli Defense Forces, ran her over, as Stanley said. And the bulldozer that he was driving was a Caterpillar D9. We'll talk about why that's significant in a few minutes. Rachel was trying to prevent what she believed was a home demolition about to happen. The Israeli government says that it was not doing home demolitions there in that area that day. However, subsequently, the same home was damaged at a later date, and then it was destroyed by the Israeli government in January of 2004. Of course, in the argument that has ensued since then, in terms of what happened, the Israeli government has been saying that the soldier driving the bulldozer didn't see Rachel, or if he did see her, he thought she was going to get out of the way. There are pictures out on the World Wide Web, which, to me anyway, make it quite obvious that the person driving the bulldozer must have seen her, or at the very least should have seen her. But at this point, I want to welcome Craig and Cindy Corrie to the show, which we're broadcasting live and will be repeated this Saturday. Craig and Cindy will be coming to speak at the Portsmouth UU Church, which is on 292 State Street, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. That'll be on Tuesday, October 4th at 7 p.m. Welcome to the airwaves of WSCA in Portsmouth.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for being here. In the aftermath of Rachel's death, I know that you have been talking with the Israeli government, with the U.S. government, about trying to do something about what happened. And could you go into a little bit of discussion about what kind of results you've gotten, if any, from either the Israeli government or the U.S. government?
Well, I think the results have been disappointing. But we have worked, first starting with our government. When Rachel was killed, Cindy and I were living in Charlotte, North Carolina, and we flew immediately to the Washington, D.C. area to be with our son, who was living there, and then thinking that we would fly from there to bring Rachel's body back from Rafah. We were told pretty immediately that we should not try to go to bring Rachel's body back. And working with the State Department there, they said we shouldn't do that. Then we heard from Rachel's congressman that he thought, he didn't have any special knowledge, but he thought that the war with Iraq was about to break out. And indeed it was. Rachel was killed on the Sunday before we started bombing in Iraq. And then we found out that the embassy in Tel Aviv was at, I think, one-third staff or something like that. So we knew something was up, and essentially we were told that if the war broke out, the borders might easily be closed, and we may never get Rachel's body back if we actually tried to do that ourselves. But at any rate, that's a long way of saying that we got to Washington, D.C., and met with Rachel's congressman, who is now our congressman, Congressman Baird. And Cindy, maybe you should tell what you did there on that first meeting.
Well, I would awake, or I wasn't really able to sleep, but I knew how strongly Rachel felt about the war in Iraq. And one of her reasons for wanting to be in Palestine at the time was because there was a feeling that things would get much worse there for people, or could get much worse there for people if we were involved in Iraq if there was the distraction of Iraq. And actually, I don't feel that happened right immediately at the time, but it certainly did in the ensuing years. But I wrote, I couldn't sleep, and so I just wrote Rachel's views. I was sitting at the computer, and on, I guess it was the second morning after Rachel's killing, we needed to go into the congressman's office. We were working on trying to get Rachel home. And when I went, I took this piece that I had written, and I said, I just need to share this with her representatives, with her senators in Congress, because I need to be her voice. I know how strongly she felt about this. And the congressman read it, and he looked at me, and he said, you can do a press conference, which was, you know, not at all something that I had considered or thought about or ever imagined myself doing. But that's, in fact, what happened that week. And with Mike, our congressman, Rachel's congressman, and two others from Washington State, we stood outside of the one of the office buildings in Washington, D.C., and really shared Rachel's views. And so from that point forward, we found ourselves, you know, addressing these issues with people in the U.S. Congress. And Congressman Baird initiated a resolution at the time. It was called HCR 111, which simply called for an independent U.S. investigation into Rachel's killing. And it expired at the end of last year, at the end of the 108th congressional session. It had 78 co-sponsors with Brian Baird signed on to it, which it was quite a remarkable number, because what we learned was that to get any kind of resolution or any statement through the U.S. Congress that implies any criticism at all of the government of Israel is a real challenge. So to have that number of supporters was quite an accomplishment. It took a lot of work on the part of our family and on the part of constituents across this country. There were people that lobbied for HCR 111. It did not get a hearing before the U.S. Congress, and as I said, it did die in committee. But our family's efforts with the Congress continue, and we've continued to work with the State Department and also now with the Justice Department, still trying to get the U.S. government to ensure that there's an independent investigation, or that the look at what happened at Rachel by the government of Israel is adequate. But the progress there is very slow.
Am I correct in saying that you do you have a pending lawsuit against the Israeli government and Caterpillar?
Yes, we do. We filed those, I guess, on March 15th of this year, both of those. And the one against the Israelis, I guess, we are still trying to find, you know, find out what information they have about what happened to Rachel. So one of the things when you file a lawsuit is that you, one of the first things that ought to happen is that we should have access to the Israelis' files about that. That has not happened yet, and as a matter of fact, this August, the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, passed a law saying that no one that was harmed by the Israeli military in the occupied zone or any zone that they designate as a, the term of art they use, I think it's a area of violence or something like that. At any rate, an area that they designate outside their border has a right to compensation. No one has the right to compensation. And they can determine where that area is after somebody has been injured, and indeed the rule is retroactive back to September of 2000. So that eliminates our lawsuit along with several others of internationals, and of course just hundreds if not thousands of lawsuits by Palestinians. It also, I think remarkably, sort of gives a green light going forward that that at least the Israeli military can do with impunity, can do anything in this occupation, which of course is contradictory to international law. It's the rationale behind that, to be sort of fair about it, is that in an actual war zone, each side is responsible for their own losses. But what's going on in Palestine is not legally, a war is an occupation, and under occupation, under international law, the occupier is responsible for all the losses in either area. So in our case, we are not a U.S. citizen either side of that war, if it were a war. So anyway, that stalled out. We're not sure exactly. Technically, we're still in the courts, but we don't know what the next move is, but we would suppose that it would be to have it thrown out. So that's with that lawsuit. We have filed also a lawsuit in the U.S. Superior Court of Western Washington against Caterpillar Corporation, and that's filed under a legal precedent now that's been set in Unocal suits and some other suits against international corporations who aid and abet in human rights violations. And there is a longstanding law that has recently been taken and upheld by the Supreme Court that says a U.S. citizen has the right, and other citizens, as a matter of fact, have the right to sue in U.S. court about losses where corporations have aided and abetted in human rights violations. So our allegation there is that Caterpillar continued to sell bulldozers to the Israeli military long after they knew or should have known that those bulldozers were used to destroy the homes of innocent people that weren't doing anything wrong, as in the case of the family that Rachel was protecting.
I'd like to just add that in regard to the Israeli lawsuit and that law that has just recently been passed in the Israeli Knesset, that human rights organizations throughout Palestine and Israel, Israeli human rights organizations as well, have come out strongly criticizing that law and opposing it. We've actually been asked to communicate with members of our government, with the Congress and with the State Department to urge our government officials to challenge that law because, as Craig pointed out, it doesn't stand under international law, certainly. I'd also like to point out that with the Caterpillar suit, we were really very happy that there are Palestinians that have joined that lawsuit, Palestinians whose family members were killed in home demolitions or severely injured in home demolitions that occurred in Gaza and also in Jenin in 2002. And then one further thing, in regards to our work with the U.S. government trying to get an independent investigation into Rachel's killing, there are a couple points that I think are very important. One is that there was an Israeli military police investigation that was done, and that was completed, I believe, in May of 2003. There were no charges brought. The case was closed. And at that time, the Israeli government declined to release their report to the U.S. government, which was very stunning to our family. The State Department continued to work on that, and eventually two members of the American Embassy were allowed to read the report, and they found inconsistencies in it. After some more work, eventually in August of that year, Craig and I were able to read the report, and a few other members of our family have now, during this past year, actually been able to read the report by going to the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. But the report is still not released. This is the Israeli report on the killing, on Rachel's killing, on the investigation that occurred, and it's still not released to the U.S. government. But having had an opportunity to see the results of it and to have embassy officials read it and so forth, we received, in reply to a question about whether the U.S. government thought the investigation was adequate, we received a letter from Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the chief of staff to Colin Powell. And he stated in that letter, it was June of 2004, I believe, that our question was a good one, and that he could say without equivocation that the investigation did not meet the standard of being thorough and transparent and credible and transparent, which was a standard that was set. Actually, an investigation had been promised to President Bush by Prime Minister Sharon on March 17th, the day after Rachel was killed, and that was the standard that was set. And the chief of staff to Colin Powell has put in writing to our family that that standard has not been met. And that was subsequently reinforced, restated again before a committee of the U.S. Congress, a subcommittee that deals with human rights, and received a human rights report from our State Department in which Ambassador Kozak also really reconfirmed that the State Department stands by that position stated by Mr. Wilkerson.
Well, tell me, in terms of both after, right after Rachel's death and now you're out speaking constantly on a tour, what has the media coverage been like? I mean, I know that, Cindy, you were just on Democracy Now! Probably a month or so ago. But in terms of mainstream media, have they stayed away from Rachel's and your stories?
You know, there has been coverage in different places, and as you point out, really our lives have been transformed. We've been they were, of course, at the moment we learned of Rachel's death, but we have devoted our time to working on this issue, and not. Not simply on getting investigation into what happened to Rachel, but on the entire issue. And we don't think of ourselves really as touring. We did go on a tour recently when part of the family, the Nasrallah family, came. We were able to bring them to the United States, which was really amazing. This is the family whose house Rachel was standing to protect, and we were in seven states traveling, and we were very. For the most part, really very pleased with the interest in that story and in the press coverage of it throughout the U.S. And I would say that, you know, it varies from place to place, but that there was a lot of interest in the story and a lot of attention to it. From the very beginning, I would say there wasn't, you know, coverage of this story, at least not for very long, on mainstream television or... There was some newspaper coverage, but it was very quickly out of the news. There have been some times when it popped up again. I think that the alternative media, certainly Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman has followed the story very closely, and the mainstream media continues to be aware of it.
I think on that tour that we were on, I remember in Iowa, for instance, and where Cindy and I are both from Iowa, we have relatives. Her sister certainly helped a lot in putting on talks in Iowa, but there was a lot of mainstream, 6 o'clock, 10 o'clock news sort of coverage in the television there, which we were very grateful because, it gets the story out to a group of people that might not hear it. We're grateful certainly for the sort of coverage that we get on alternative media. And that's wonderful, but sometimes I feel like we're just preaching to the choir there. And that is wonderful. You still need to get past that somehow. And so I know that different places on that tour we were able to do that. And it's a powerful message. We were traveling, like Cindy said, with this family, and it's a family that I can see out on the internet or on the sort of talk hate radio that you sometimes hear that's been accused of being terrorists. And it's this young man. His wife, and they had their 15-month-old baby with them. And you could see, here are people that not just a visa to come to the United States, for which a male has to be thoroughly checked out, but they got a visa to go into Israel to Tel Aviv to apply for the visa to come to the United States. So both the Israeli government and the U.S. government have certified that this lovely family, you know, there's nothing that they've done wrong or anything like that. But of course, they spent months having their house shot through by the Israeli military and eventually destroyed. And Rachel was killed standing in front of a wall that these people were standing behind. You know, it wasn't just the house she was protecting, but it was the lives of four adults and at that time five children.
And you're listening to WSCA LP FM 106.1 FM in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I'm Tom Jackson, and I'm talking with Cindy and Craig Corey, parents of Rachel Corey, who was working with the International Solidarity Movement and stationed at the Gaza Strip when she was killed by an Israeli Defense Forces bulldozer. Rachel was trying to protect a home which she thought was about to be demolished. Sticking with the subject of what the mainstream media covers and what it doesn't, just for another moment. Of course, back this summer, there was extensive coverage of the evacuation of settlers from the Gaza Strip. And, I'm my feeling was that you could see the anguish that they were going through, and that it was a hard thing for them to deal with, of course. But my recollection is that when, you know, the many demolitions of Palestinians' homes, which has included people getting killed inside the homes as they're being demolished, took place, those occurrences didn't really get a whole lot of attention in the mainstream media. I would be interested to hear, did you see or hear much about the evacuations of the settlers this past summer, and what your feelings were as that was happening?
We were in Iowa at the time that the disengagement was happening, and Rachel's grandmother, my husband's mother, lives there in Des Moines, and so we did see TV news coverage of it, and I wouldn't say that we watched it extensively, but we did see some of the photos and the broad coverage of it. And I had different reactions to it. First of all, the amount of coverage was amazing, and I was hearing about hundreds and hundreds of reporters being there to firsthand cover Gaza disengagement. And, I had to compare that with the amount of coverage that there was of the home demolitions that have occurred in the Gaza Strip during the past 4 years. Rachel struggled to get her story out. One of the things that she wanted most to do was to, with the emails that she had written, with the information she had written about what she was seeing there, was to get her local newspaper to write and to include her words. And she was a good writer. But the local newspaper from our hometown didn't carry anything until after she was killed. You know, the kind of demolitions that happened during 2004, Operation Rainbow and so forth, in which many people were killed, hundreds of homes were destroyed. Human Rights Watch says that between September 2000 and 2004, I think in Rafah alone, one-tenth of the population there has lost their homes. And over 1,700 homes were destroyed. And these people did not, they didn't have warning. They were not helped out of their homes. Things were not moved out of their homes for them. They weren't given other places to live or money from a government to go build somewhere else. And yet their story it was in the news for a brief time, but visually and so forth, we saw nothing like we saw when disengagement happened. And really heard very little about it. And Craig and I were in Rafah. We spent time there. We know something about the number of reporters because there were some reporters there. So we know about the small number of reporters that are down there on a regular basis. So the contrast was amazing.
I don't think it's just a matter of reporters, though. It seems to me that I think most Americans are probably kind of like Cindy and I were before Rachel decided to go to Palestine. We knew a lot about and identified with the Israeli story and the story of Jews coming after the Holocaust to Israel and looking to build a place where they could find some safety. And that's a story that we were very familiar with. But we didn't know the Palestinian story. And it's to really hear about the sort of destruction that we have seen, that Rachel witnessed, that went on, particularly in Rafah, it's a very painful thing, I think, for most of us to hear. It's something that we don't like to hear. And frankly, I think that editors find it hard to cover. I mean, there's much more broad coverage of this in Europe and in Great Britain, and we know of writers who have written stories, and then the editors won't run them or change them. So I think my guess is I'm a businessman. My guess is that the mainstream media does not want to put out a story that they think their public really doesn't want to buy. That's a bit of a business, and that's incredibly dangerous. If I'm right about that, that's incredibly dangerous when it's our news media that's looking at their customers that way.
I think, to answer the other part of your question, which was the reaction to people losing their homes in disengagement. I think, of course, it was painful to watch that, and I felt empathy for the settlers who were losing their homes. As I know, I spoke to people in Gaza, Palestinians, who said the same thing. They felt empathy watching the settlers lose their homes at that time. I think all you have to do is look at what's happened in Louisiana. In some ways, I think the hurricanes have brought Americans closer to understanding some of this and what it really means, what it means to have, you know, be dropping bombs on communities in Iraq, or what it means when 10% of a population of Rafah lose their homes to this kind of thing. I think we have maybe a better understanding this month than we did a month ago. But I felt, yeah, I felt sad, of course, about watching the settler families lose their homes. But I think that it's really important for all of us to keep in mind that those homes were on Palestinian land. There's really no question about that under international law. That is Palestinian land. They were homes that were there illegally. They should never have been built there in the first place. And I think, as I pointed out, they were to receive a great deal of compensation. They were moved. The soldiers came into their communities without guns, without weapons, as I understand it. And, you know, really embraced these settlers and supported them in this transition, which is without question a difficult transition for people, not one that I'd have to go through either. But I think it's important to keep in mind the distinction between what happened to the settlers in Gaza and what has happened to the Palestinians there.
I'd be interested to hear your opinions about this change with the, you know, getting the settlers out of from the Gaza Strip and now Palestinians moving back in. But of course, in the last 24 hours, there's been a report of some fighting between Israeli troops and Palestinians in that region. Is what has transpired in the last couple of months, a major step in the right direction? In your opinion, is what else is needed to change the dynamic there that could possibly bring about peace?
Oh, that too is a hugely complicated question. I think that the withdrawal out of Gaza, just simply that part of it, was a step in the right direction to try and lift the checkpoint, for instance, that divided Gaza apart to get, as Cindy said, the illegal settlements out of Palestinian soil. To try and remove an occupying army at least back to the borders. But as that was originally drawn up, it really was going to leave, the original plans were to leave Israel in complete control of all the borders, of the sea, of the air, and in fact of the underneath the ground of the water supplies and stuff. So it would leave Gaza in a state of siege rather than occupation. But perhaps siege is better than occupation. And it was a step in the right direction. I think Cindy and I are very saddened about both the, essentially it sounds like Hamas doing rocket attacks then across the borders, and if the IDF has been reinvaded or firing back, that's certainly unhelpful. At the same time that that Israel was doing what they talked about publicly was this unilateral withdrawal, I think a little bit more privately within their country, they said, well, it was bilateral negotiations, but of course the negotiations were with the United States, not with the Palestinians. And those negotiations were aimed at, if they withdraw out of Gaza, can they keep the settlements in the West Bank, which is religiously more significant to Jews, and it has better water supplies, and you know, some ways of more value. So, so there seems to have been a quid pro quo, as is put forward by the letters between Prime Minister Sharon and President Bush, the summer of 2004, And so if the result of withdrawing from Gaza Strip is that it leaves the Palestinians in small cantons in a little portion of the West Bank, then that certainly is not positive. And so we need to be watching all that goes on there and working for in favor of human rights, both for the Palestinians and for the Israeli people.
I think it's terribly important that Americans keep insisting that we have renewed negotiations, that what happened in Gaza, a unilateral disengagement, isn't allowed to, that same approach to things isn't allowed to happen in the West Bank, because ultimately I believe there will not be peace if that happens. And we really need to insist that settlement expansion, thickening, and so forth, that stop, and that home demolitions and so forth stop. Those continue in the West Bank and around Jerusalem, and around Jerusalem. Land confiscation continues around Jerusalem in those areas. And so as Americans, we need to insist that not continue, that our government be firm about that.
I think sometimes, you know, Americans think of this when we talk about territory and taking territory, that we think of it maybe in political terms, that if somehow, I don't know, if Vermont was to take over New Hampshire, you know, what would happen to New Hampshire? Well, I guess you'd pay state taxes to Vermont, and maybe instead of cheering on your own college football team, you'd have to cheer on Vermont's or something. And those would be travesties, but you still have your homes, you still have your farms, you still have your factories, you still have your family. But what's happening over there is not simply a political transfer. It's not where you would have rights in Israel that were comparable to the rights you ought to have in Palestine. You know, your home gets bulldozed. Sometimes your children get shot, or your grandmother gets crushed in the home. It's destroyed. Your orchards, your olive orchards, or your orange groves get bulldozed as well. There's no way to make a living. Your land is taken from you and given to somebody else. And on a very personal basis, you know, it's hard for me to distinguish that from just flat stealing. You know, it's a little closer to being mugged than having some sort of political transfer. And of course, then the violence does come back the other way. And so when we look at the violence, I think we have to look at it on both sides and see it as human rights violations, and insist that it stop, and that the solution be found in accordance with international law, I think.
Your daughter, of course, ultimately gave her life in her quest for peace and doing peace work in Israel, Palestine. And that's such a tremendous thing to those of us who, do peace work. Of course, there's a recognition that we need to take risks at times, and she certainly clearly did. What, for people who want to do something, for people who, you know, maybe have been watching the Israel-Palestine issue and they want to think of things that they could possibly do to try to make a difference, what would you suggest? And maybe specifically, what can people do in Rachel's memory, in memory of her?
Well, I think there are a number of ways. I think this is another one of those issues where it's important not to sit back, really, as I did for many, many years, and feel like there was nothing you could do. It was just always a problem that was going to be there forever. Because it's important for us to engage with this issue, and as Americans, I think, to understand our role in it, to understand that we are really funding the Israeli military. We purchased, Craig and I believe that our tax dollars purchased the Caterpillar D9 bulldozer that killed Rachel. As Americans, I think, first of all, recognizing our role and responsibility here and joining those Israelis. We've met wonderful people from the Israeli peace movement And so joining Israelis and internationals and Palestinians and other Americans who are really working so hard to try to reach a just solution to this problem so that there ultimately can be peace. I think we just, first of all, need to decide that we're going to engage with it. There are some ways to do that. I would say, you know, look for the local organizations that are giving this some attention. Here in Olympia, we have the Olympia Rafa Sister City Project, which was formed after Rachel was killed. Rachel wanted to build connections between her community and with the community of Rafa, and that work is continuing. We're hoping to have, you know, some people from our group actually get to Rafa during the next 6 months or so. I know that not every community could start a sister city project, but I think tuning in to what's happening in the news and bringing attention to it through education, bringing speakers to your community, getting involved in the churches. A lot of church groups now have taken positions on this issue and are actively involved in various ways, some working on divestment. The Presbyterian Church is working on divestment from the occupation, not from the whole government of Israel, not from the people of Israel, but from occupation and so forth. That's one avenue of work. But there's a tremendous amount of education, I think, to be done in this country, just helping Americans come to understand what's going on and how we have been a part of this. I think with lobbying, there's a lot of education to be done in the U.S. Congress, and forming local lobbying groups who focus on this issue, meeting with your representatives and senators' offices with specific requests. There are groups in the country. The U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation does an excellent job, and you can go to their website. It's www.endtheoccupation.org, and by signing up with them, you can be you can receive email that will tell you things that you should be sharing with your senators or your representatives around this issue.
And I think I was going to chime in there. One way to do that we've been taught actually by a congressman in the Bay Area whose name I forget right at this second, but is to go to their town hall meetings and respectfully bring up the issue and your views about it in a town hall meeting, because a couple things happen then. You are not only talking to the your representative or your congressman, either senator or representative, but you're also talking to the people that are there, so you're getting your message out. You're talking to the press because the press is there, and this congressman happened to say that his reply would always be, well, I'll get right on that, he said. And then he kind of looked at us and he said, but I'm going to forget it. I won't get right on it. He said, so you come back to my next town hall meeting and say, Congressman, what did you find out? And he said, now you've got it twice in front of the press and in front of the people and in front of me. And he said, and what's more, I don't want to see you a third time. That second time, I will be on it. So I'd encourage people to get involved just in the town hall meetings. I know that's a huge tradition in New Hampshire. And bring the issue up in a respectful way. You know, in this, Cindy and I certainly don't feel like we're fighting Israelis. We're fighting the actions of Israeli government. But we have many friends who are Israeli, and much of our support has come from Israelis. So all this needs to be done lovingly, I think. But it needs to be done.
The media work to be done, you brought up the media earlier, and there's an organization called Palestine Media Watch. I'm sorry I don't have the website in front of me, but if you Google Palestine Media Watch, you will find good information about how to, as an individual or as a group, to work on the media coverage of this issue. There's been a lot of work done that illustrates that how, for example, how the deaths of children are covered in our media. A group called If Americans Knew has documented that the deaths of Israeli children are covered much more broadly in our media than are the deaths of Palestinian children, for example. And so taking on projects like this, with just watching your own newspaper to kind of monitor the coverage is a very helpful thing for people to do, and there's guidance for how to do that if you go to this organization, Palestine Media Watch, or to If American News. So I would encourage people to get involved in that way. It's always, I think, helpful to see with your own eyes. And so if people have the ability to make a trip to Palestine and Israel, I would really recommend that. I think Rachel really opened my eyes. That's where emails, when I started to hear from her, I remember I talked to my son, Chris, and I said, what do you think about what she's writing? And he said, it's really amazing. It's a perspective I've never heard before. And then when I went myself, when Craig and I went in September of 2003 and saw with our own eyes, that understanding of what was going on was just extended that much more. So if people can find a way, there are the Fellowship of Reconciliation takes groups there. There are Sabil, which is a group organized by Palestinian Christians, takes groups over. And there are a number, if you just start looking, there are a number of organizations that the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions is a wonderful organization that also encourages people to come and does tours and does a wonderful job of laying out the what's the facts on the ground, what's really happened there in terms of the infrastructure. So I would encourage people who can visit to do that. In terms of what to do, you know, in Rachel's memory, certainly that whole idea of just doing something, recognizing that as individuals we all have the power to do something and engaging in some way with this issue, I think is the most important thing. We do have a foundation that we're working to get off the ground. It's called the Rachel Corey Foundation for Peace and Justice. There is a website that's just off the ground, too. It's www.rachelsfoundation.org or the rachelcoreyfoundation.org. And, we would certainly be glad for people to look at a little bit of the work that we're trying to do. But there are many organizations to support and so forth. And I think it's just to engage in some way with this issue.
Okay, I just want to go back for just a second to something that Craig touched on. For people who are wanting to talk about or voice their concern for what has been happening and continues to happen in Israel-Palestine, I think there's probably sometimes some reluctance or concern because of the volatility of the issue, and when a discussion starts on that issue, it can sometimes sort of unravel into shouting matches or whatever, and accusations from any number of different angles, whether it's anti-Semitic, anti-Jew, anti-Israel, anti-Palestinian, anti-Muslim. Those kind of accusations will sometimes get thrown around. Have you had to face that? And if so, how do you go about responding to that sort of accusation?
I think in a way we have not had to face it very much. There's certainly things thrown about on the internet about us that way, but usually not to our face. And I think part of that is because, for one thing, help was given to us. Jews, both in the United States, internationally, and from Israel, reached out to us immediately. So our feeling, in some ways, it seems to me that particularly when you hear about this from governments, from people working in the government, that it's like George Bush saying you're either with us or against us. There's a dichotomy that tries to get driven into the discussion and a polarization. And that's really on a different plane than I see any of this. Because when you're talking about human rights violations, then you have to point to them wherever you see them. And it doesn't make any difference who does the violating. It simply has to be stopped. It has to be refused to do that. So I'm reminded, one of the big political questions in the Palestinian issue is, are you in favor of a one-state solution or a two-state solution there? And I remember hearing from an Israeli who had asked that of a Palestinian. And the Palestinian answered, I'm in favor of a two-state solution. I want one state for all of us that get along together and just want to live, and another state for everybody that wants to keep on fighting. And I think people have to just start out realizing they cannot be sucked into discussing this in terms of the dichotomy that others want to put it in. You can't go around defending somebody's actions that are human rights violations and when you're trying to tell somebody else not to do it. You have to be consistent at being against human rights violations.
I think, it's important. We're speaking out against the human rights violations that occur on both sides, certainly, but also against a 38-year occupation and oppression of the Palestinian people. And in doing that, anti-Semitism isn't really a part of this. It isn't, and I think, fortunately, we're supported in that view by wonderful Jewish American organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace that make it very clear that opposing these acts and this oppression, this occupation that's been carried on by the Israeli government is not anti-Semitism. And I think, I guess that's part of drawing the distinctions that Craig talks about and not being drawn into that part of the discussion, that kind of discussion.
All right. Well, Cindy and Craig Corey will be speaking at the UU Church on 292 State Street in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, on Tuesday, October 4th at 7 p.m. Cindy and Craig, I thank you so much for the time that you spent with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. All right. Look forward to meeting people in New Hampshire.
And we look forward to having you here.
When she sat down in the dirt in front of your machine, a lovely woman dressed in red, you in military green. If you had met her in Jerusalem, you might have asked her on a date. But here you were in Gaza, rolling towards the gate. As your foot went to the floor, did you recall her eyes? Did her gaze remind you that you've become what you despise? As you rolled on towards this woman and ignored all shouts to stop, did you feel a shred of doubt as you watched her body drop? As your caterpillar tracks upon her body pressed with 60 tons of deadly force, crushed the bones within her chest, could you feel the contours of her face as you took her life away? Did you serve your country well on that cool spring day? This just another day in a dirty war. When you looked out on the water, did you feel an empty void? Or was it just one more life you've taken, one more home destroyed? One more home destroyed.
That was David Rovics with A Song for Rachel Corey. Thanks so much for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice, here on WSCA LPFM 106.1. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Myrowitz, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation, too. Please contact us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. We leave you today with this quote by Eleanor Roosevelt. It isn't enough to talk about peace. One must believe in it, and it isn't enough to believe in it. One must work at it.